Morning, Your Honors. Andy Bouchard for the appellant. I'd like to reintroduce to the court my co-counsel from the Jones Day Law Firm, Mr. Jade Tombay, who will be making the argument today, and Ms. Marguerite Doherty.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court.
Counsel.
I thank the court for the opportunity to present argument on behalf of the trustee seeking a reversal of the Court of Chancery's ruling, which permitted cancellation of certain notes in a manner that is not provided for by the indenture, and in a manner that subverts and undermines the express provisions of the indenture. As an indenture trustee, Bank of America's role is to follow the express provisions, the express guidance that is set forth in the indenture. It is a complex document. This is a very complex and heavily engineered transaction. The issuer of the notes at issue in this case is a special purpose vehicle. It is not a Loral Aerospace. It is not an RJR Nabisco. It is a vehicle that was created specifically for one purpose and one purpose alone, which was the issuance of this series of about $400 million worth of notes to purchase collateral with the proceeds of that issuance, and then, very importantly, to turn all of that collateral over in pledge, in a security interest, to the trustee, for the trustee to administer pursuant to the terms of the indenture. There's no dispute in this case that the indenture simply has no provision that permits cancellation of the notes in the manner that the cancellation has been attempted here. It's also the case that there is nothing in the indenture that expressly prohibits such cancellation. And so the issue is, what do we make of that? What do we make of the silence of the indenture, where it does not specifically prohibit the action that is sought here? And I think we have three sources of guidance. And let me start with a case that is strikingly similar to the case that we have before the court, and that's the IBJ Schroeder case. That's a Second Circuit case. And in IBJ Schroeder, you had a trustee that challenged an action that an issuer had sought to take on the grounds that, just like here, the action that the issuer had sought to take was not specifically prohibited by the indenture, but ran contrary to the indenture and ran contrary to the relationship between the issuer and the notes. At trial, the trial court disagreed with the trustee, and the trustee appealed to the Second Circuit, and the Second Circuit reversed. And the Second Circuit reversed because what was being sought by the issuer was effectively what we have argued is happening here, which is an attempt by the issuer to dance between the raindrops. Seeing that there is no specific prohibition of an act, the argument is made, well, if it's not specifically prohibited, then it should be permitted. And that argument falls short because when you give effect to that type of conduct, you run headlong into the specific provisions of the indenture. What are the specific provisions of the indenture that I'm referring to? The seniority. There's a very clear provision, and it appears over and over again in the indenture, that the A1s have seniority over the A2s, and so on all the way down the various tranches.
Before you get to that, let's back up for a moment because I think we need to identify the nature of the issue before us. We don't have, I mean, your lead-in position is that whether or not there can be a cancellation without consideration depends on the terms of the indenture.
That's right.
But you then go on and state, because it's undeniable, that there is no provision in the indenture that speaks to this issue one way or the other, that is, expressly and affirmatively or expressly and negatively. Would it not follow, in that case, that there is some presumption or rule of construction that would be used as a guide under New York law? That's number one. And number two, if that is right, how does Schroeder read on that?
Going to your first point, Your Honor, there is a rule of construction, and we cite it in our papers. There is a provision in the indenture that speaks to cancellation and the circumstances in which notes can be canceled.
But there's no provision that says that those that it is the exclusive method of canceling.
That is right, but there is a canon of construction, contract construction, that says when the parties have enumerated certain circumstances under which, in this case, cancellation is permitted, by not addressing other provisions, they have meant to exclude them. That's one.
Expressio unius.
That's right, Your Honor.
Is that Schroeder?
That's not Schroeder. Schroeder goes to a different point. Schroeder doesn't rest on that principle. What Schroeder rests on is if you are going to imply rights into a contract where the contract is silent, you cannot do so in a manner that conflicts with the express provisions of the contract. So while you may
which express provision is being conflicted here?
So the express provisions that are being conflicted with here are the priority of payments and the subordination principles, because the effect of what is sought by the cancellation is to divert money that would otherwise be used to pay down principal on the super senior notes, the A1 notes. Instead, it is being diverted to the very lowest notes, with the least seniority, the preferred shares.
But doesn't that put the rabbit in the hat? That is, that happens only if you have a violation of the contractual ratios. And what's happening here are steps being taken, steps that are not prohibited, to prevent a violation from happening. And without such a violation, you don't have the problem that you're just alluding to.
And that's exactly what IBJ Schroeder speaks to, because there's no dispute in this case that the reason the cancellation was sought was an advance of an impending breach of the par coverage test. It's alleged in the complaint. That's the specific reason why this cancellation was sought, to avoid that coverage test from being tripped.
But wasn't the consequence, whether we call it cancellation, surrendering, if the notes had any value, they were walking away from the value of these particular notes? They had certainly done a cost-benefit analysis, but in effect, weren't they surrendering these notes without consideration, just walking away from any value they might have?
Absolutely, that's what they were doing. And the question before the court is, what is the effect of that cancellation, not on the rights of those who are surrendering? The note holders who surrendered the notes and relinquished all right to principal and interest walked away.
I know. Well, help us understand that when you're talking about, you're going to move into the trenches and talk about the seniority of the notes and the subordination and different things. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, if notes were non-existent, certain things would take place. And I don't think the parties ever contemplated that anyone would walk away from the value of any of the notes, did they?
I think that's right. I don't think anyone contemplated that the notes would be delivered for zero consideration. And the reason why it made any economic sense for these note holders to walk away from those notes is because they're affiliates of the holders of the preferred shares. By tendering their own notes, which are the E notes, the F notes, by tendering those notes for no consideration, what they hope to achieve is money flowing down the priority of payments to the preferred shares. And the preferred shares happen to be affiliates of the folks who tendered their notes. It's exactly the type of end run that the IBJ Schroeder case says should not be permitted. You cannot look for this gap in the indenture and say, well, it's not specifically prohibited, therefore I can do it, when what the result of that is to upset the express provisions of the indenture, the relationship between the issuer and the note holder.
I'm still trying to wrap my arms around what the doctrinal basis of Schroeder was. It isn't this case. Different facts.
It's one of the bases we have offered for why the Court of Chancery was wrong. The primary basis we have offered is that the indenture does speak to cancellation. It enumerates the reasons, the circumstances under which cancellation can be done. This is not one of them. One. Two, the Court of Chancery looked to the model indentures.
Does Schroeder stand for the proposition that under New York law, where a provision enumerates several ways that notes can be canceled, that has to be interpreted as exclusive, even though the contract doesn't say so?
No, IBJ Schroeder does not speak to the exclusio unis principle. What it does speak to is that the contract should be read as a whole. The provision that the issuer was trying to take advantage of in IBJ Schroeder was an isolated provision that dealt with the payment of certain funds into the structure. And in isolation, they were permitted to do what they did. It certainly didn't prohibit them from doing what they did. And what the Second Circuit did was say, you cannot look at that provision in isolation. You have to read all the provisions together. That is certainly what we are urging here, because if you read the cancellation provision along with Section 11, which is a priority of payments, and Section 13, which is a subordination principle, what you see is a clear intent by the parties to favor the A1s at the expense of other note holders when those coverage tests are breached.
You referred earlier to the raindrops and avoiding through the Schroeder case the intent of the parties, but in Schroeder, was there a backdrop of common law that filled in the gaps, such as the delivery rule?
I think the two answers to that. The Second Circuit didn't specifically seek out or identify a common law principle, other than if it's not prohibited, it should be permitted, because that's certainly what the district court found in IBJ Schroeder.
Can I ask another hypothetical question? You've explained, and I think I understand, that the reason why these notes were canceled for zero consideration was because an affiliate would benefit by that, mm-hmm. and apparently the benefit would be greater than the loss of the value of those notes, right?
That's right. Because okay. based...
Okay. I assume there was nothing in the indenture that said that note holders have to only be in one tranche, you know, that they can't have different interests in this whole in note arrangement. You see what I'm getting at?
I think that's right. There's no prohibition on owning different tranches of notes.
Okay. So it seems as if this happening, this event, certainly could have been expected that at some point somebody who owned a higher level security would say, well, you know, I want to do one thing or another with one of my set of notes because it'll benefit me more with another set of notes. Although I think everybody agrees nobody thought things would get as bad as they got, isn't it significant that there was no prohibition on having this kind of relationship with other note holders that worked in a way that made it economically advantageous to cancel notes for zero consideration?
I think certainly when presented with this fact pattern where we find ourselves, we can look back and say, well, there are certainly things that maybe should have more expressly and clearly been stated. The argument is, well, it would have been easy to say, for example, to add a clause that says, in addition to 2.9, there shall be no cancellation in circumstance X or Y.
Right, but what I'm talking about is in terms of what was or was not within the expectation of the parties and so forth, that people hedge their bets all the time. So it would not be that unusual to think that an investor might want some higher level, more secure notes and some lower level securities, and that way have some protection in case things worked out the way they did this time.
I think certainly that argument can be made, but we have to consider that argument against the backdrop of what the parties did provide for in the indenture. And what they did provide for is when the collateral deteriorates, so when the par coverage tests begin to fail, that circumstance was thought about, and it was addressed in a very particular way. The way it was addressed is, cash flows would be diverted to begin paying down the A1s, and it's only when the A1s were paid down, you'd then pay down the A2s, et cetera. So this is not a failure to think about a circumstance where there would be deterioration in the deal. That was dealt with. It was specifically addressed. What we have here is an effort to avoid that express provision that expressly dealt with that scenario. The collateral is no better with the cancellation of these notes. So if you look at it from the A1's perspective, what the A1s had bargained for, Concord says the parties bargained for an equation that tests leverage, not results. That's absurd. No one here bargained for an equation in the abstract. They bargained for what are the consequences when that equation fails. That's what the bargain was, and that bargain is very clear in the indenture.
And that goes back to my question, and I just want you to help me understand this. If you bargain for something, and part of the bargain talks about priorities, and someone drops out, then the priorities are realigned. So in this case, we basically have someone who dropped out, don't we?
We do have someone who dropped out, but there's someone who dropped out below the most senior level. And we know from the cash flow analysis that was set forth in the court's opinion what the effect of that is. $500,000 that would have been used to pay down the super senior in that first month instead went to the most junior tranche, the one that's the first loss piece. And that, by the way, is what IBJ Schroeder points to, which is...
Right. I know. And so, but and tell us your legal argument for why someone couldn't drop out.
And here's why. One, it's not expressly permitted by the indenture. The trustee can only act pursuant to express instructions from the indenture. If it's not there expressly, it has to be implied. You can't imply it if it's going to conflict with other express provisions. Thirdly, you can't imply it because the delivery rule that was invoked by the Court of Chancery doesn't apply in the multilateral context. Not a single case has been cited where that rule that goes back 120 years has been used in a multilateral context where one creditor's relinquishment of its rights affects the rights of another creditor. That's never been the case. So there is no common law delivery rule that can be imported to get the result that Concord wants to achieve here.
Counsel, just two factual questions. What is the value of the notes that were surrendered without consideration?
It's roughly $68 million, I believe. It's in the 60s.
And what was the benefit, the offsetting benefit that was achieved?
It would be achieved over a period of time. So in the numbers that appear in the Court of Chancery's opinion are based on the data that was available when the papers were filed.
You have a number?
As of December of this year, it's roughly between $25 and $30 million that would have gone to pay down the A1s. Instead, it's going to go down through the waterfall to various lower tranches.
So you're saying that notes having a value of $68 million were surrendered to generate $25 to $30 million of benefit?
Just in year one. Just in year one. This deal goes to 2046, I believe. I mean, so this is going to keep the net positive effect, if cancellation is permitted here, keeps compounding.
So it's every year?
It's every year. It's every month.
Don't we have an overarching common law principle that the holder of property has the freedom to control what happens to it at the disposition of the property? And why wouldn't your argument contravene that principle if you're saying you can't cancel the notes even when there's no term prohibiting it?
Not at all, Your Honor. We take no quarrel with the holder relinquishing its right. If the holder wants to relinquish its right, that's fine. What we have a quarrel with and what we think the indenture doesn't permit is for that surrender of notes by that holder to affect the rights of others who have not surrendered. For example, the A1s and the A2s, who are directly affected by that right being exercised by the holder.
That's where I'm having a problem, too. Are you arguing that... based on your side's construction of the agreement, that the senior note holders could not surrender for no consideration, or alternatively, that yes, they could surrender for no consideration, but that would have no legal effect on the computation of whether or not there's been a violation of
the second point.
Contractual ratio.
It's the second point. It's not that they don't have the right to surrender, but that surrender cannot be treated in the manner that they wanted to be treated to affect distributions to the other note holders who did not surrender.
But that rewrites the formula, doesn't it?
It does not rewrite the formula. It goes to how and in what circumstances are notes going to be considered outstanding or not considered outstanding. Here what's being sought is an attempt to manipulate that formula by doing a cancellation in a way that's not permitted by the indenture and in a way that has the effect of redirecting cash flows away from the most senior to the most junior. So, in fact, it preserves the formula. The formula will still be calculated on the basis of the outstanding notes. And most importantly, seniority will be preserved. I can see I'm into my rebuttal time.
Do you want to save the balance of your time?
I would like to, Your Honor. Right. Thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices. The issue on the appeal is a straightforward one of whether the subject notes are outstanding, as that term is used in the indenture. That's the issue on appeal. That's what was decided by the court below. With due respect to my friend's arguments, I think the answer to that question is no, and I think the analysis that the court below engaged in was entirely correct. That the analysis that resolves the issue is also I think, quite simple and straightforward, and the course of briefing and argument has helped to clarify the issues. It is uncontested that the subject notes were surrendered by the holder to the issuer for cancellation, renouncing all of its right, title, and interest in the notes and into any payment under the notes. It's uncontested that the effect of that surrender under New York law was to discharge the obligation so that there's no longer any debt owing on those notes, neither for interest nor for principal. And it is undisputed that the notes were delivered to the notes registrar for cancellation, delivered to Bank of America in its role as notes registrar explicitly.
Is there significance to that role as opposed to its role as a trustee?
There is, Your Honor. And the significance appears in the terms of the indenture itself. Because if you look at the provision that my friend would like to focus on, Section 2.9, it mandates actions by the trustee, by Bank of America in its role as trustee. It says if A, B, or C occurs, then the trustee shall do something. Right? Then you have the definition of outstanding, which is a key definition here. It's the key definition that we need to worry about here. And the very first category under the definition of outstanding, it says notes, all notes that have been issued are outstanding, except for certain enumerated categories. The very first category of those is notes that have been canceled by the notes registrar, not the trustee, the notes registrar, or delivered for cancellation to the notes registrar. So when you lay 2.9 against the definition of outstanding, you can see that all of the things that the trustee does in 2.9, that is, it cancels notes when they are surrendered for payment, when they're redeemed, when they're lost or stolen or exchanged, all of those things are addressed in subcategories 2, 3, and 4 of the definition of outstanding. But the notes registrar piece is separate, additional, and supplemental. That's subcategory 1 under the definition of outstanding. And to give effect to that, you have to understand that there is authority in the notes registrar to cancel. Now, I would suggest to you that the authority is both implicit and explicit.
Mr. Nolan, I think that you're quite right that as a result of the briefing, the issue has now been refined. It appears that there's now no longer any dispute that the surrender of the senior notes for cancellation discharged the obligation. The argument is that that fact has no impact at all contractually. That is, it cannot be read to have the effect of preventing a breach or a default, that would trigger the other consequences. That is, the early repayment of the more senior debt. Given that the indenture doesn't really address that point, how are we, under what rule of New York law are we to be guided in deciding that one way or the other?
Well, I think you are to be guided by several rules of New York law. First is the principle that's fundamental to New York law, just as it is to Delaware law, that you read a contract to give effect to all of its provisions. You cannot read the contract, you cannot read subparagraph 1 of the definition of outstanding out of the contract, right? Outstanding is the term that we're concerned with because the effect on the par value test is the reduction in the numerator, right? And the numerator is defined as the aggregate outstanding amount of the notes, which is in turn expressed in terms of the aggregate principal balance on the notes, which itself suggests that one shouldn't continue to consider as owing, principal that is not owing anymore. But the first one is that fundamental rule of construction, that you don't read a provision out of the note. You don't read out of the contract. You don't read subparagraph 1 out.
It's the outstanding amount's the denominator, isn't it?
The denominator. Okay. Did I misspeak and say numerator? I apologize if I did so.
Well, but before you go any further, isn't it correct that the notes could not be redeemed for a penny? That is impermissible?
Yes, that is correct. The notes could not be redeemed. There are specific redemption provisions, and no attempt was made to redeem notes.
I understand, but in terms of your saying that what we're supposed to do is read the indenture as a whole, how do you get us to find no contradiction there? In other words, it's okay to cancel notes for zero consideration, but because it doesn't specifically say you can't. But on the other hand, you couldn't redeem the notes for a penny, which is arguably close to an equivalent type of transaction.
Well, I would submit that it is not close to an equivalent type of transaction, that the argument to that effect is inaccurate, because redemption is a very different kind of thing. Redemption is an involuntary act. This is not the issuer going out and requiring redemption.
I understand that they're not the same.
It's a very different kind of act. It operates on really the opposite premise. Secondly, the terms of redemption, there's no option here for anybody under this contract to redeem for a penny, because the terms of the redemption are fixed by the contract. Now,
you agree that there's some inconsistency in the sense that it was anticipated that a redemption could not be for no value, and arguably it was anticipated that a cancellation could not be for no value, at least for purposes of the par value test?
Your Honor, no, I don't think that's right, because again, I go back to redemption being an involuntary act on the part of the holder of the notes. All right? When the company says we are going to redeem you, that's not a voluntary act on the part of the holder of the notes. One is always free to alienate one's property except as bound by positive law or as bound by contract. So in a cancellation scenario, the holder of the notes is voluntarily giving up the notes. And no one actually contests in this litigation that the holder of the notes was perfectly free to voluntarily give up the notes.
Right. But
the question is cancellation.
The question is how it affects the par value test.
Right. And it affects the par value test through the definition of outstanding. And it's that very definition as to which I would suggest it would be impermissible to read out one of the four subparagraphs and to give effect only to the other three subparagraphs and to Section 2.9. Now, on the point of cancellation, I mentioned, in going back, Your Honor, to your question, that there are some other principles of law that I think we need to look at. One of those principles of law is that the indenture as to an issuer is a restrictive document. It's not an enabling document. The issuer maintains authority to act except as bound by the specific terms of the indenture. And that is what our cases say. The Loral case says that indentures are to be read strictly, and to the extent they do not expressly restrict the rights of the issuer is left with the freedom to act subject only to the boundaries of positive law. That's the Loral case. And the Rheology case says it is the burden of the trustee to prove that a restriction prohibits particular action. It's not the burden of the issuer to prove that it has the authority to take action. And that's really very much consistent with the indenture here, which contains at Section 7.8 a lengthy a list of negative covenants, which would be entirely unnecessary if only that which were permitted, you know, was prohibited, and everything else was prohibited. And it is consistent with other general principles of our law. So you look at the
document. So if the agreement doesn't say you can't do it, then you can.
That's correct. That's correct. And, you know, obviously the agreement would be subject to a duty of good faith and fair dealing, which is implied and so forth. The courts have been very reluctant to read that in. And, in fact, that has never been argued here as a basis for relief by Bank of America.
Okay, if so, I can just interrupt for 1 minute, because there's a piece of the ruling that's on appeal that I don't know how it fits anymore. There was quite a bit of space in the Vice Chancellor's opinion devoted to the delivery rule. And there's a gap-filling doctrine, given that the agreement itself didn't specifically address the question that we have. Is that any longer an issue in the case, given that it's now conceded that the effect of the delivery of the notes for cancellation without consideration discharged the obligation?
No, I don't believe that is a point of contention on the appeal.
Is that, I mean, there's a lot of discussion in the briefs about whether there is a delivery rule, whether there isn't, what effect it has. Is that any longer something that we need to consider?
No, I don't believe it is, except to the following extent. Okay, and I shouldn't even say except to the following extent, because it doesn't contest, the Bank of America doesn't contest any longer that delivery had the effect of wiping out the notes as a debt. Okay, but what Bank of America says is, well, that's a bilateral transaction. It shouldn't be given effect in this multilateral context. That argument, that secondary argument, is, I think, a complete red herring, because the rights and duties of the parties are laid out in the indenture here. We're not looking to some abstract principle that a party cannot alienate his own property if that will have an effect on someone else, or else I wouldn't be able to sell my house to somebody who my neighbor doesn't like, right? But if it violates the terms of the contract, you cannot do it. If it doesn't violate the terms of the contract, you can, and that is a fundamental principle.
I understood the delivery rule, as it was treated in the opinion, to go only to the issue of whether once there's a delivery, you know, is the obligation extinguished.
I understand it the same way, Your Honor.
It doesn't go, tell me if I have this wrong, to the issue that we're now being asked to focus on, which is, okay, if the obligation is extinguished, does that have any impact on the application of the par value test?
I agree with you, Your Honor. I believe the delivery rule is not at issue any longer.
Would you also agree that this set of circumstances was not contemplated by the parties? In other words, a situation where a note holder would be better off canceling the notes for zero consideration in order to maintain cash flow to other securities?
I don't believe that there is any evidence that it was or was not anticipated by the parties. I suspect that neither of the parties at the time specifically thought about the issue, but that is why contracts are made. Is to allocate rights and responsibilities, and to anticipate contingencies, or to provide for unanticipated contingencies. And so, in the context of trust indentures, that is permitted, which is not prohibited. That's how trust indentures are read. So yes, I would agree with you that it's unlikely that the possibility of a cancellation was expressly considered. Certainly, there's no evidence that it was negotiated, just as there is no evidence that any note holder here thought that a cancellation was treading upon its contractual expectations. I mean, after all, when this cancellation was requested, Bank of America sent every note holder correspondence saying, this cancellation has been requested. Please send us comments about it. And then when the lawsuit was filed, Bank of America again solicited the note holders with correspondence. Bank of America moved for summary judgment here without putting in one scintilla of evidence from any note holder that this was contrary to that note holder's expectations. And you can be sure that if it had had such evidence in moving for summary judgment, it would have put that in. So that reflects on the expectations of the market and of the note holders as well as anything.
Well, does the Model Act suggest that the market and the note holders would expect that these can be canceled for any reasons? Isn't there language in the model APA provision?
Your Honor, the model indenture actually contains commentary that says that it is implicit. One would think it would be implicit that an issuer could cancel notes.
I'll think of my question in a minute.
We've talked about the fact that Section 2.9, when laid against the definition of outstanding.
I now recall it. Right. Pardon me. Since we are in the position, in effect, of having to determine what the New York law is and then apply it, you know, this is a quest for cases. And it appears that the best case for the other side, we are told, is Schroeder. I'd like your views on whether or not that is true, and why, if not, why not, and what is your side's best case?
Well, I'm delighted that the other side thinks the best case for it is Schroeder, because Schroeder doesn't get the court halfway there. Schroeder is a case where, ironically, the Second Circuit said the problem with the decision was below was that it failed to read all of the provisions of the contract together. It failed to give effect to all of the provisions of the contract. And that is exactly what Bank of America is asking this court to do, to fail to give effect to the provisions of the contract. Secondly, it was clear in Schroeder that the expectations of the parties were being undermined and subverted, I think my friend used as his phrase. That isn't at all the case here. It isn't the case because there's no evidence submitted by Bank of America, but it's also the case because the trust indenture, if you look at it just within its four corners, it's clear that this test, the par value test that is supposedly being manipulated, was one that was intended to measure leverage. It was one as to which both the numerator and the denominator were variable. These parties didn't select a test that provided for a static numerator. They could have. They could have said, well, $413,850,000 worth of notes, the authorized amount under Section 2.3 are being issued here, and let's make that the numerator. They didn't do that. They made a variable numerator because what they were concerned about was leverage, the relationship of the value of the collateral to the value of the debt. And what Bank of America's position would require the court to do is to say the collateral is still going to be valued on whatever the contractual basis is, which is in part a market value. But for the denominator, we're going to treat as debt that which we know is no longer debt. We're going to include all of the notes that were originally issued, regardless of whether they represent debt. So that would not be a leverage test. That would be a test.
As in Schroeder, that would fail, excuse me, to give effect to an explicit term of the agreement. Correct?
Yes.
And that provision is what? Where is that found?
Well, the provision that it would fail to give effect to is the definition of outstanding.
Okay.
Because outstanding factors into the calculation of the denominator.
As I understand the other side's position, if you measure this before the actual cancellation, that your argument frustrates the single mechanism intended under that circumstance, which is to pay down the senior note holders, right?
Well, Bank of America may make that argument, but if it does, that is not an argument that this court ought to accept, because the priorities are not being rejiggered here. What was bargained for by the note holders was payment of principal in the event of a failure of the par value test. There has been no failure of the par value test here, right? They didn't say, well, we get to be repaid our principal if we're close to a failure, if we're in the vicinity of a failure. They didn't do that. They get paid. If there's a failure, principal starts to come out early. Now, Bank of America's argument seems to suggest that the note holders are being permanently deprived of that principal. They're not. They're going to be paid principal at the end of the day, you know, on the maturity of the notes or as principal gets paid out under the terms of the notes, and they're going to be paid that principal with interest, with the interest that was negotiated. So it's not as if the note holders have irrevocably lost some value here. They have lost no value here. The only thing that has changed is they're not getting paid out principal, having notes, you know.
They're not getting bought out early.
They're not getting bought out early. And many of these investors are institutions who peg these things to annuities or whatever. Maybe they don't want to be bought out early, and maybe that's why we haven't heard anything from them about their expectations.
The second part of my earlier question was, what is your best case, if you have one?
Our best case, Your Honor, if you look at the Delaware cases that rely on New York cases, rely on the Metropolitan Life case, which arose out of the RJR Nabisco LBO. The Delaware cases draw a number of principles from that case, but Amlin and Realogy and Loral are all quite relevant to these provisions. Now, I see that my time is winding down, so if I may, I'd like to wrap up. I believe that the judgment below was clearly correct. By holding as no longer outstanding notes that all parties agree are no longer debts, the court's judgment accords with reality. It arranges the parties' rights on the basis of fact, not fiction, not pretending that notes are still outstanding that aren't, and it is consistent with the nature of the leverage test that they chose. It provides, moreover, for keeping accurate, not inaccurate, records. Because remember, the notes registrar has to keep an accurate notes register that the trustee then uses to make payments of principal and interest. Why in the world would anyone keep a notes register that reflects notes as outstanding that aren't outstanding anymore? It would lead to confusion. The court below gave meaning to every provision of the indenture instead of regarding a key part of the definition of outstanding as meaningless or reading it out of the indenture. And the judgment below preserved the bargain struck: redemption of senior notes only if a par value test is failed, not where there's just a risk of failure or we're somewhere close to failure.
Thank you, Mr. Nolan.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
if I can start you with a comment or a statement made by Mr. Nolan that none of the other note holders have presented any evidence as to what their expectations are or were. Would you comment on that?
I can, Your Honor. Again, this is an effort by Concord to point to an absence of something in the record and say, therefore, the facts must be as why. Fact of the matter is the trustee is charged with interpreting the indenture. The trustee has always made clear to the note holders what position it intended to take with respect to this request for cancellation. It took that position, and when the district court decision, when the Chancery Court decision was issued, we have been in contact with senior note holders. They know we're going to continue to press the points that we have been making all along since this cancellation was first suggested to this point in time. In fact, there are restrictions on the ability of note holders to act independently.
Well, I'm not talking, Mr. Nolan suggested that you would have likely gotten affidavits from institutions or whatever saying, you know, this was our expectation as to what this indenture would provide and what security would have under the par value test. And nothing along those lines was presented. Granted, that doesn't mean necessarily that the other note holders have a different view, but wouldn't you agree that that would have been helpful to the trial court if the parties had a different expectation?
I think, again, as a matter of contract interpretation, it's unclear whether those affidavits would have been properly considered. I mean, the point that was presented by both sides is the contract is clear, the intent of the parties is clear. It can be gleaned from the indenture. The fact that today some note holder says my expectation is X may be interesting to hear, but at the end of the day, what this court has to decide is what was the intention of the parties, as can be gleaned from the written documents. What is not proper and not fair, I believe, in response to my friend's comments, is that there is no interest at the senior note holder level about what happens in this case. That is most decidedly not the case. I want to go back to a point that was raised about what is it that has been conceded or not conceded with respect to the delivery rule. Bank of America has been very clear. The holder of the notes has the right to tender those notes and relinquish all right to principal and interest. We don't dispute that aspect of it at all. The question is, what effect does that surrender have on the way this indenture is to be interpreted? And what we have said with respect to that aspect, again, it is an aspect of the delivery rule, as it were, you cannot treat these as no longer outstanding, because to do so would be to undermine all of these provisions, these express provisions of seniority and subordination.
And the response,
the definition of outstanding that you would apply then? I mean, the indenture says notes canceled by the notes registrar or delivered to the notes registrar for cancellation.
So one, if the notes registrar does not have the authority to cancel under these circumstances, the mere fact that that's what the definition says doesn't make it so. If it in fact were so, 2.9 would be superfluous. The notes registrar.
But aren't those in the alternative?
Those are not in the alternative, Your Honor. If I could go to the definition of outstanding.
I'll read it. Notes theretofore canceled by the notes registrar or delivered to the notes registrar for cancellation.
That's where I come from, or means in the alternative, not where you come from?
No, maybe I misunderstood your question, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the notes registrar, this doesn't empower the notes registrar to do anything. It's a definition. What types of notes and under what circumstances can the notes registrar cancel? It is a ministerial task.
Well, if in its capacity as a notes registrar, doesn't Bank of America, upon acceptance of the delivery, ministerially cancel the notes to the effect they're no longer outstanding under that section?
If and only if, in fact, the indenture permits us to cancel the notes under those circumstances. If notes were delivered to us as notes registrar and they fit within the confines of 2.9, absolutely we'd cancel them. But there is no express authority in the indenture that says when notes are delivered in these circumstances, you must cancel them, cancel them.
So it's not a ministerial act as notes registrar?
Absolutely not. You can only
is
get
that a, where the trial judge got it wrong? It seemed to me in his holding to say that there are two capacities in which Bank of America acts. Mm-hmm. One is as a trustee interpreting the indenture, also as a notes registrar. And under these circumstances, these notes are no longer outstanding because they have been delivered by the issuer, mm-hmm. who can cancel the obligation, to the notes registrar for cancellation, a ministerial act.
And that was in error, because they can only be treated as canceled. In fact, they were cancelable under the indenture.
But you agree that was his holding?
That was his holding, and we disagree with that aspect of it as well. If we go back to IBJ Schroeder, the case they cite is Metropolitan Life versus RJR Nabisco. And in that case, what the court found, what the New York court found, and that's the case that's relied upon by Loral, is that you cannot imply a provision into an indenture unless it is clear that that is the provision that the parties would have put in the indenture had they focused on the issue. And if you apply that test, because that's the test from New York law as to when and how you imply a provision or a right into an indenture, it would defy all logic and it would run contrary to all of the express provisions of the indenture to imply a provision that says, in the face of 2.9, there is freedom to cancel under any circumstances for zero consideration. I thank the court for its time and its consideration of this matter. And
thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.